Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, I am blessed to be in dialogue with Sylvia Nakamuli. She is a cookery teacher and Italian-Jewish food specialist living in London, England. We are here today to discuss her new book, Jewish Flavors of Italy, a family cookbook, published in London by Green Bean Books 2023. Sylvia, I am unbelievably blessed to be in dialogue with you today.
Hello. Thank you, Ari. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the chef and cook and writer you would become as an adult?
Yes. So I am from Rome. I was born and grew up in Rome, in Italy. And I then moved to Israel, where I did my undergraduate in Israel in political science, and then I moved to London 25 years ago, so quite some time. But my formative years in Italy were really growing up in an Italian Jewish family, which is a bit of a double whammy, but as food is concerned, it's probably a good end result. So surrounded by food and people and Italian and particularly Roman Jewish tradition, that was in a nutshell. That's the way I grew up.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to readers in this cookbook?
Yes, so it's a two-layered answer. I think one is a sense of responsibility by having been perhaps the first in hundreds of years in my family that left Italy, because we could trace my family. Rome is the oldest Jewish community in the Western world, and the Jews have been there for up to 2,000 years, if not longer. And I feel a sense of responsibility about keeping those traditions alive. So food is one of the things that we keep and we bring wherever we go, and that survives perhaps the longest. So part of my aim is to really keep those traditions alive and bring a message of inspiring young or old alike to cook and to explore flavors which are, yes, Italian, but they do have a history, they do have a cultural baggage behind, and to try to understand the source and what inspires the recipes.
What are the primary themes in your book? What quote-unquote story does your cookbook tell?
I think the family. So it's a family cookbook. That's quite important. And the reason that I bring up the family is because for me, it's really important to bring food to life. So I think it's not just what we eat and how we nourish our body, but why we decide to eat what we eat. So I think that's a really central point.
What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
I would love them to be inspired and finish to listen to this and open the book and start cooking. or to learn something, saying, oh, I didn't know this about Italian Jews, or I didn't know that they were Italian Jews, or I didn't know that the Italian Jews eat rice for Pesach, and but they're still not Sephardi, so how can it be? So I've loved people to just question things or discover things or just cook.
I hope so too. Toward the end of the book, you present the poem La Sparshandata by Giudaico Romanescu. Who was he? Can you describe the meaning of this poem?
Okay, so Giudaico Romanescu, it is not a name. Giudaico Romanescu means simply Roman Jewish. So yes. It is a poem which is the author seems unknown. So they have, I found it in the book by Tuaf. Ariel Tuaf, it's this book in one poem. It's like the story of Italian Jewish cuisine into a poem. It's like a list of over, I think there are more than 200 dishes that Roman Jews, and not only, because it also mentions names of dishes that go in the Livorno, in Venice, and other cities in Italy, what they used to eat. And the poem is written at the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century. And it's basically una ode. How do you say ode in English? It's like a poem, like a song to a home cook, a woman, and said, okay, show me what you can do. And she said, oh, I am Italian Jewish and I can cook such a varieties of dishes. And then she just goes into a kosher rule. She starts by saying, I keep kosher rules, are really important. And then she just goes on and starts giving this list of over 200 dishes that she makes. So somehow it's a testimony. It's like a legacy of what Roman Jews or Italian Jews ate over 100 years ago.
Wow. How has Italy's Libyan Jewish community impacted contemporary Italian Jewish cuisine? Can you comment on the mutual influence of Libyan and Italian cuisines on one another?
Yes, I think that's a really fascinating question, because Italian cooking, like any other cooking, is really created by the influence within and from outside. So the Italian cuisine is Italian Jewish cuisine. It's Italian in flavors because Jews have been there for so long, but has been inspired by the local cuisine in order to conform and then to conform to kosher rules and created new dishes. And then they had like Jews coming from many different countries throughout the centuries. And the Libyan Jews is the latest waves of immigrants that came after 1967, when they really escaped basically almost overnight. And being an old Italian colony, Italy was one of the main places where I ended up going. Still others went to Israel and the States. And they brought with them, as Jews do, and not only Jews, their own cooking traditions and their own ingredients. And they really kept it very, very preciously. And they kept on cooking those wonderful dishes, such as the chaimi or the merduma or mafrum or the sefra. There's like a large varieties of dishes. And when they came to Rome, they introduced them slowly through the Italian tradition. So today, if you go to the restaurants in the Jewish area of Rome, you do find a lot of restaurants that do offer a few Libyan, in particular Tripolitanian from Tripoli, dishes, and they really enriched the Italian tradition. So whenever I used to go as a child or a teenager to a friend's house, and the mother used to be from Tripoli, the food was mostly from Tripoli, so it was not that much kind of Roman Jewish as I was used to. But then, of course, being in Italy, they also incorporated and adopted a lot of the wonderful ingredients that you find in Italy, and they kind of then, as happens, is a marriage of cultures and the two kind of live alongside nowadays.
In light of what you just alluded to, mm-hmm. how has the kosher and Jewish restaurant scene in Italy changed in recent decades? What are the most noteworthy kosher restaurants in Rome, Milan, Venice, and elsewhere in Italy? What cuisines are represented? What are the present culinary trends?
Yes. So it's became the kosher scenes has really flourished in the last decade or two. And when I grew up, there was really almost nothing. If you would go to the Jewish area where there used to be once the ghetto, in what is called the piazza, Piazza Ebraica, in the Portico d'Ottavia, there was no, maybe one or two kosher restaurants. And now, because it became very much of a central spot, like a hot spot for tourists, and there's a lot of very interesting Jewish tourism, and not necessarily Jewish, then a lot of restaurants really start being created. And also the another things that changed it as well was the, in Rome in particular, was the Jewish school, because there's one Jewish school that didn't used to be in the Jewish ghetto. And since they moved it in the main ghetto, then the whole area has been really revived and a lot of restaurants start opening up. So people come out of school and go and eat something local. There can be it's a great little fast food. I am not a fast food person at all, but like a fast food, the Roman Jewish way. It's like there's this one little place, it's called Fonzie's, where they make, so the Rome, they have wonderful ways of curing beef or cutting, having specific kind of cut of beef. So you have carne secca, or which is like dried cured meat. And that's based on the idea that I mentioned earlier, that you're inspired by the local cuisine, which in Italy would be like cold cuts of pork, for example, and make it kosher. And so in this case, you would use the beef and you cure it, and you can make sausages, you can make dried cuts. And in the fast food, you have these sandwiches, which is basari, it's a meaty, and you have this wonderful Roman Jewish cuts of meat in the, or a concha, which is a marinated fried courgettes, which just in the area. So even the fast food has got a bit of a soul of its own. I know there are kosher restaurants in Florence and in Venice. I haven't tried to be totally honest. I don't eat much in a kosher restaurant, as they say that the best food is mama's food. So whenever I am in Rome, I do tend to eat more at my parents. But I do take the kind of the odd slice of pizza or a piece of pizza Ebraica from Boccione, the kosher bakery in Rome, which is really tasty.
In what ways is your approach to cooking similar to or different from your mother's and grandmother's? How is your cooking style similar to or different from your sister's and sister-in-law's?
So it's all one family, so you can see a family way of cooking. And the Nakamulis, that's my last name, we've always quite known to cook quite well. So everyone in my family, both my mother and my father and my aunt and uncle and grandmother, everyone kind of cooks quite well, and everyone is always very happy to come over for a meal. My mom, she's I think she's the best cook, I must admit. And she's really been an inspiration on everything that I've learned. I learned it through her. And I learned it by inertia, by just absorbing it, really. She works and she's super busy. She never said, "Come, darling, I teach you how to do that." She just kind of gets on with it. So you just need to watch and eat. And then eventually you just, by living it. So I learned really by absorbing it. So I think by having been away for Italy for longer than actually by now, I actually lived in Italy. My cooking, as my father in particular says, has been contaminated by a lot of different other ingredients. So maybe my flavor is a little bit richer, I guess. I dare to experiment a bit, although in the book I really tried my best to keep the recipe as really they are and how as they would do in Italy. My sister's cooking also, it's very similar, it's very good. She explores a little bit more also. My grandmother's, they had very different style of cooking, however. One was very abundant in quantities and in type of creativity, and the other one was very minimalistic and doing always kind of more similar, the same dishes over and over, and quantities smaller. So I think that's quite an interesting kind of background. But I both they both had to give, and I took whatever whatever they wanted to share culinary wise.
What was a typical Friday night Shabbat dinner like in your home growing up? What are Shabbat dinners like in your home today as an adult with your own family? What were your favorite conversation topics at a Shabbat dinner table when you were younger? And what are they today with your own guests?
Lovely questions. So Friday night dinners, when I was quite young, we used to be at my Nonna Emma's and Nonno Sandro's home. And they are the grandparents that I mentioned earlier, the second, the latter one. So the menu was always the same and the quantities were more kind of smaller, which was a frittata di spaghetti, a spaghetti frittata. They kept Shabbat, so everything had to be ready before and served either warm or room temperature. I'm not sure they had a hot plate then. And there was like a stew of some type and a dessert, a slice of cake, but it was just enough for everyone. And then we moved to my parents when my grandparents became a little bit more elderly. And then my parents are very kind of more abundant. We always have at least maybe 10 different types of vegetables to share at the table. And we're very seasonal on what we eat. So my parents would never have a fixed menu for Friday night. And it would ever be whatever they find at the market and whatever it makes a sense on that night. But the quantities would be abundant on that. And today I do Friday nights in London, and we have, I change menus every night, every Friday night. So I don't have a fixed menu. I kind of very much follow my parents' path of seasonality, and as far as discussion goes, in Italy it's all talking one on top of each other. So there's no one conversation, and probably there's like four conversations going on at the same time, and everyone listening at each other, and no one listening at anyone, And here in London, there's less of us. There's four of us, and then my sister-in-law who comes, Anne, my husband's sister. And so there's less of us. And we talk, my daughters are 11, so perhaps the conversation, they are more kind of children friendly, but they sometimes even a bit existential. They kind of start asking a lot of existential questions. So we try to go with those as well as the everyday life. But we very much enjoy the Friday night's dinner every week.
How did the Spanish Inquisition impact Italian Jewish food? How did the influx of Jewish refugees from Spain impact Italian Jewish cooking? How did the need to disguise or replace ingredients impact Italian Jewish cuisine?
Okay, so these two parts of these questions, the first and the second one. The first part of the Spanish Inquisition, so Italy had a lot of influx of immigrants throughout the centuries, and Italy is not Italy as we know it today until only about 140 years ago. Before it was like 150 years ago, and before it was like a conglomerate of independent states. So the south of Italy, Sicily, Calabria, Puglia, and Sardinia were part of the Spanish Empire. So with the beginning of the Spanish Inquisition, because it kind of went through really for some times, the Jews in 1492 and then later in 1541, they were expelled from Sicily, where there were more than 40,000 Jews living in Sicily at the time. So that's just perhaps a larger number than, not perhaps, it is definitely a larger number of the all of Jews living in the whole of Italy today. And then later on, they moved also from the area around Naples and Puglia. And they brought with them their own cooking traditions and their own ingredients, a little bit like what we're talking about, the Limbia Jews, although the cooking perhaps was not as radically different as the one of Libya. It was still, the flavors quite Italian. So they introduced new ingredients like aubergines, which in Sicily still today it's very widely eaten, and a combination of pine nuts and raisins. I was in Palermo, and I remember walking the market there and seeing this little sachet of pine nuts and raisins that they just sell because people put it so much into the cooking. And that's very much of a Spanish or Sephardi influence in the cooking. But Sicily has been always a melting pot of cultures and of influences from all over the Mediterranean. Perhaps I would call it almost the capital really of all the Mediterranean trade throughout the centuries. And when the Jews moved and settled in the center and north of Italy, they brought those ingredients with them, and they introduced them and kept on cooking them, despite the rest of most of the Italian population not really eating them. And the aubergine is particularly interesting because it's been defined as the vile food of the Jews by Pellegrino Artusi, who is one of the kind of founders of Italian cuisine, and wrote a really important book written more than 100 years ago. So it's interesting to see how the Jews basically had an interest or a culture of or a tradition to use and cook the specific ingredients independently of the address of the Italy. So then you could see that with aubergines, you can see that with pumpkin, you can see that with fennel, that of course now they're like widely spread and cooked and eaten and enjoyed by the rest of Italian population. But the Jews were amongst the first to use them. To go to the second part of your question, I am not sure that they tried to hide. I can't remember exactly how. What was the second part of the question? But I don't think
how did the Inquisition, how did the Inquisition impact how Jews in Italy cooked, what they cooked? Was it different in Italy than elsewhere in the Catholic world?
Yeah, I'm not so sure if it was a matter of because of the Inquisition in any shape. I mean, the Inquisition just forced somehow the movement of the Jews, and with the forced movement, then kind of ingredients traveled with them and were introduced. But is the one that were left, the Jews that were left in Sicily, either converted or were killed, and the one that converted them, they didn't need to keep any traditions alive because there was nothing really that much different that they were doing, I think, compared to the rest of the local population.
How did Italian Jewish cuisine change and evolve as a result of the discovery of the New World and the colonization of the New World? How did Italian Jewish cookery adapt to new ingredients from the Americas, to Jewish migration to and from the Americas, and to the economic consequences of colonialism in the Americas?
Okay, so the new ingredients that came with the discovery of Americans are the wonderful tomatoes, potatoes, corn, peppers, and just to mention a few. And they came and they really revolutionized totally. If you think of Italian cooking now, and think of Italian cooking or Mediterranean cooking without tomatoes, it's almost hard to think. But those were really new ingredients, and the cocoa and the coffee that came. Because Jews, especially in the north by that time, like with the Spanish Inquisition, with the conversos, they were a lot into trade. They were amongst the first one to use and to get the tomatoes in that case, or the cocoa, and they really had a very early tradition of incorporating them in their cooking, like in Livorno, for example, which is the only Italian city that never had a ghetto in Italy. There was a Porto Franco. They actually invited all the conversos, in particular, all the Jews to came join really the economic growth, because it was really a jewel of town, of economic growth at the time. And they brought with them all those kind of new ingredients. So it's just not, meaning the Jews didn't discover necessarily anything as such. They were just among the first one who happened to bring them and to make them part of their cooking. So in Livorno, we have the triglie alla mosaica or alla livornese, which is also in my book, which is with tomato sauce, which is really delicious. That's the way that slowly then they spread across all the other regions and any religious denomination.
How much do you know about your family's history in previous generations? Can you speak about your family's history during the years 1939 to 1945?
Yes, so it's funny because when you ask a family history, I was starting thinking over 500 years ago, 800 years ago.
By all means.
Because I know. No, I don't know. Because from my mother's side, I think we looked into it. We could look up to, I don't know, how many, more than 10, 13, 16 generations in Italy. So it goes quite a long way. And my father's side, my grandfather was from Venice, and then Nakamuli go there. For probably at least a couple of hundred years, if not before. But talking about more recent history, I incorporated one thing that I decided to include in the book, besides the recipe, and besides the history of Italian Jewish cuisine, and it's the family side of how my parents and how my family really survived during the Second World War, because it's very much part of my identity and who I am today, and why I do what I do, even connected to food, because I think it really reflects I don't know, the way that my parents gave us a Jewish identity, and that's very much connected, I think, to the war. So they were both hidden children. One, my father, he was saved, and he was hiding in a boarding school, in a convent, really. And my mother, she was born in 41, so she was very small, but she was still hidden for 9 months into the house of the ex-housekeeper of my great-grandmother, whose name was Silvia, by the way. And their story, I think, is quite incredible, and they were very lucky to be alive, really, and to go through it. And not all my family survived. Some of my grandparents' siblings in both sides perished, and one even went and came back from Auschwitz and wrote a memoir. So I thought, as an Italian Jew, as a part of that sense of responsibility of keeping tradition and memory alive, I share their stories in the book.
Can you tell us about your Nonna Bianca and your Nonna Bino?
Yes, Bino. Yes, so Nonna Bianca and my daughters, so my I got twin daughters, and they one is called Bianca after my late grandmother, and the other one is Thea after my husband's late grandmother. Nonna Bianca was my father's mother, and Nonno Bino was her husband, and he was from Venice, so he was Bino. Actually, his name is Abramo, but he was called Bino Nakamulli, and he came actually to Rome in the 1930s. And the rest of his family that was in Venice, they were all they all got deported. My grandma, they were really wonderful, really kind of sunny disposition. Used to have Thursday lunches at home for all the family, for us and for our cousins. And there were about 15 of us as an average at the table. And my Nonna Bianca, my grandfather, he passed when I was about 10, but Nonna Bianca, she was there until my late 30s. So I enjoyed her company really. For quite some time, and she was just a pure inspiration. She cooked very well. She always had wise words. She always was supportive of whatever we were doing, but always trying to teach us a lesson of life and in between.
Can you tell us about your Nonno Sandro and your Nonna Emma?
Yes, well done. So Nonna Sandra and Emma were my mom's parents. Very different in character, but still very, very important, very central in our upbringing. My Nonna Emma, she was a primary teacher at school, so she helped me almost every day after school doing my homework. She was quite strict, but she was good. And Nonno Sandro, he was wonderful, very elegant man, always with a hat, and they used to call him Signor Buonasera when he was always hello and bowing and really very always so happy to see us, and really like a simple, wonderful grandfather as well. I've been very lucky to have the four of them actually.
Can you tell us about some of the new trends in Italian Jewish cooking in the past 30 years, in the past decades? How have European integration, globalization, and the proliferation of the internet impacted Italian Jewish cuisine?
Yes. Yes, I think it's, as you put it very well there, it's really about globalization of food and being able to access other recipes or the culture. Like perhaps let's take Hanukkah, who just passed. So the sufganiyot is really Israelis, which Israel is a relatively young country to start with, as if you see it within the context of a 2,000 years old community. So, but the sufganiyot are quite similar, for example, to the Italian bomboloni, but I never really grew up with Hanukkah and sufganiyot. So it's something that it's been newly added to the Italian Jewish repertoire, which we very welcome because they're very tasty, and we realize that we do something very similar with the bomboloni, just different filling, and then we kind of now you find them for all the time for Hanukkah, or the orecchie di Amman in Roman Jewish tradition. They're like a strip of fried pastry, so very simple. And there's the Amantaschen, which are like called the pocket of Amman, which are triangle and filled. And it's not often found. I didn't grow up again with them, which again, they're delicious. So we adopt them and now we make them. Or even the challah, the basic of kind of the really the one of the pillars of Jewish cuisine. The braiding of the challah is really an Ashkenazi a tradition to do it, which in Italy, or not in Italy, all of Italy, but Rome in particular, there's like a brown, round, plain bread. And that's what we used to make the blessing and as a challah. So the new tradition of having the bread, which is not a new tradition to break the bread, of course, but in Italy to have it as a Saturday or Friday night challah bread, is a relatively new things that I didn't grow up with. But being all wonderful ideas, we just take whatever it's great and we adapt them and add them to the repertoire.
Can you tell us about the kosher bakery Boccione? Why is it notable?
So Boccione, it's really an institution in Rome. It's in the heart of the what is called the piazza, which is the main square of in the Jewish quarter. It's what is called really a hole in a wall. It's like a little corner shop where you can't. There's no name at the top. It is really tiny inside. It's run by a family of women, really there's only women running it, and they are not particularly friendly, but they know, and they kind of really almost play with it. But their baking is just wonderful, and it's they make all the traditional Roman Jewish bakes, such as the pizza ebraica, which is a fruit cake, so with nuts and candied fruit, the torta di ricotta e visciole, ricotta and sour cherries tart, or a ricotta and chocolate, or ginetti, or cinnamon and almonds biscotti. And and that's just the only ones who make them like that. There are other bakeries now that they also sell here and there, but they are, let's say, the heart of the Roman Jewish ghetto as bakeries is concerned.
How is Italian Jewish cuisine different in different regions and locales within Italy? How is Rome's Jewish community's cooking similar to or different from Milan's, Livorno's, Sicily's, Venice's, Florence's, and others?
Okay, so the idea behind it is that the Jews arrived at different times in the different regions in Italy, and they brought with them their own cooking traditions and their own sometimes ingredients. I mentioned earlier with the aubergines and from the south, and the funnily enough, the fact that ghettos were in Italy for over 300 years, they enhanced or they allowed the conservation of traditions and way of cooking. Somehow they stopped time for that. They locked it, and as a result, you can see that there's like a Roman Jewish cuisine, a Venetian Jewish cuisine, a Livornese Jewish cuisine, and so on. And for example, you have the different ways of immigration from the north, Venice, for example. The first Jews arrived in Venice were Ashkenazi Jews, but then the ghettos, there were like three different kind of ghettos for the different types of Jews that arrived throughout the century. So you had the Ashkenazi Jews, you have the Ponentini Jews, you have the Italian Jews and Sephardi Jews, and they all brought with them their own cooking traditions and their own ingredients, and it became a wonderful melting pot. So you may have Ashkenazi influence more in Venice or in Piedmont from the Jews that came from France, of course, and all the goose recipe that I, for example, and the use of goose that I mentioned in the book, they are really from the north, because that's a tradition that Central European Jews had, but there was no real goose in the south of Italy. So in Rome, you wouldn't find any goose recipe as such. You would use more kind of beef and local ingredients, as the artichokes, you know, the carciofi alla giudia is perhaps the emblem of Italian Jewish cuisine. It's a wonderful fried artichokes that opens up like a flam flowers, and it's crispy and it's sweet and savory at the same time. It's really delicious. So every region has its own things to offer as such, and based on the influence of the Jews that arrived at different times.
You alluded to goose meat.
Yes.
And goose meat is referred to often in your book. For example, you refer to the kosher goose producer Yolanda de Cola, and you describe the attempt by Anna Campos of the Venetian Jewish community to revive the preparation of goose cold cuts. Can you tell us about the history of goose consumption among Italian mm-hmm. Jews? Can you comment on why goose consumption is less common in recent times? Can you describe the recipes you present that can incorporate goose?
Mm-hmm. Yes, with pleasure. So goose is a really fascinating ingredient because it's, although I didn't really grow up in it, in the north of Italy, has been really a central part. In Piedmont in particular, in Venice, in Modena, in Bologna. So in the north part of the Apennine, it's often defined as the pork of the Jews because of the cold cuts of meat that I mentioned before. For example, I talked about Rome and using the cold cuts of meat using beef, that the Jews in the north used the cold cuts of goose. So goose has a long history of being used amongst Ashkenazi Jews for really centuries. People used to breed their geese in their courtyard and basements and in Venice, and there were in the main area where the market was, it was like full of geese being bred there, and so it was really a primary source of meat as you would have for the perhaps from the Catholic they would eat pork as easily the Jews in the north they would eat as goose, but eventually goose generally was replaced by the use of turkey through the centuries, which was cheaper, there was more meat to it, was a bit more tender. So eventually it kind of faded away. And nowadays, and then eventually chicken took even more over it. So it just, I think, was a more of a natural death, let's say, of its use rather than being stopped for specific reasons. So it's just one of those ways that of how kind of cooking evolves and ingredients change within a specific culture. But there's some mentions that I do on the book where I go more into details of all the possible ways of which goose meat was used for making prosciutti or salsicce or the goose fat eaten and made put inside of fogazza and the pizza and every possible way. And today you can find it, but more rarely, because really there's one a producer of it, which amongst other non-kosher meat also does the kosher one, and it's sold mostly for like special occasions or as in cold cuts, but it's kind of lost that old traditions of using it, both the meat and its fat, for general cooking as it used to be a long time ago.
How do Italian Jews prepare charoset? Can you describe your recipe?
So Italian Jews, there's no one recipe. Like, I think probably charoset of all the recipes, probably one of those. Yes. There's more recipe of charoset as there are of Jews, I think. But so it really changes. The one that I, even in my family, we do a Seder night where we do all the festivals with my mother's side of the family, which are more religious and traditional, and they come over to my mom's, and there's about usually between 30 to 40 people for Seder night at ours. And even between us, we have at least three different types of charoset. The one that I propose in the book is the one that eventually I kind of made my own based on what my my cousin Manuela always does. And then my sister-in-law, Loredana, makes some. The idea is to really have a rich combination of nuts, of flavors of nuts and dried fruits. And we do always add a little bit of red wine or orange juice. Being seasoned then, the blood orange juice tends to kind of always go in there as well. But I put both hazelnuts and almonds and orange juice and red wine. I have no sugar because it's all very natural sugar and sweetness that come from the fruit. Dates going there, so you can actually be really as creative as you like. So the idea is to just for me is to share my recipe, and then for people to pick and choose either to reproduce it as such or replace any of the ingredients.
What are the most popular dishes prepared by Italian Jews on the occasion of Tu Bishvat and Shabbat Beshalach?
Yes. So there's one recipe that I propose in the book, which is a fascinating, somehow it links with the goose that we mentioned earlier, which is the Ruota del Faraone, which is it's a very interesting dish that comes from a combination of Venice and Ferrara and Bologna. It's a bit of a macabre stories really, but the idea of like Tu Bishvat and the Shabbat Beshalach tells the story of when the Jews come out from Egypt and they cross the Red Sea. So this dish, it's a pasta bake, it's a fettuccine bake, where you would cook the fettuccine, and then inside there used to be like a goose meatballs or little sausages in pieces, and then you have the pine nuts and the raisins, and they kind of represent the pastas like the waves of the sea that is closing, and then there's like the meats and the panas and the raisins are like on the horses and the Egyptian soldiers being trapped and devoured by the waters, and as we do eat juice, we just eventually make a dish out of it, it's a really interesting and it's a really lovely and really tasty dish actually, which I look forward to making in a few weeks actually.
Can you tell us about bomboloni? What is the significance of this Hanukkah dish? How is this recipe different from sufganiyot, which are perhaps more widely known elsewhere outside of Italy?
Yes, so that's what I kind of touched on it earlier. They are quite similar. I mean, the idea is that it's a similar idea, just that the bomboloni in Italy, they're made every day, and you can have people have it for breakfast. If you stop for a bar, you have a cappuccino cornetto, cappuccino bombolone, or as a teenager, you would go like a midnight to have it and with your friends and have a bomboloni con la crema. But it's like a donut, like a fried donut with filling inside. So it's on a similar way of sauvignon.
Which recipes in this book would you most recommend to a complete beginner in the kitchen? Which recipe or recipes would you most recommend to someone coming home from a very bad day? Which recipe or recipes would you most recommend for a date night?
Okay. So for an easy recipe, it's the one that always comes in my mind, which is the pollo e zecchiele, which is a chicken dish with tomato, red wine, olives, and fresh herbs. It's so easy to make. You really just put everything together and let it cook, and the flavors are so intense and so delicious. So if you eat meat, then I would definitely try the pollo e zecchiele. Or the guzzamodi, which are the meatballs in celery and tomato sauce, really lovely. As a fish dish, a very easy and delicious one is the pesce alla livornese, the Livornese fish with tomato and chili that I mentioned earlier. really, really nice and quite straightforward to make. If you are coming back home and you just want a quick dish, actually, I think the fish probably it's a really good one to do. Of my pastas, I love pastas. I gave four recipes of tomato sauce. So there's a garlic base, an onion base, an onion and garlic, and a bolognese sauce. So maybe just I would say do a large stack of bolognese sauce and just have it in the freezer and then come back home and defrost and make a bowl of pasta bolognese. I think that always works pretty well. Or a pesto. I always have pesto. There is a recipe for a fresh pesto, basil pesto. And I also that this freezes very well. So have it ready in the freezer and then make a pasta out of it. For a date night, maybe a risotto is something nice to cook in the kitchen together and just sip some wine while you show off your bit of skills of making a risotto. That would be a nice one to make, like a porcini mushroom risotto. Maybe that could be. I think it's better to cook together rather than serve a ready meal food. At least some of it, you can have the rest and then. Or a bad day, you need something sweet, I think. for a day, maybe the cake that I bake the most is the tortellina bianca, which is a lemon sponge. It's like a comfort food for desserts for me. It's I can have it in the morning dipped in milk or as a tea thing. So I would always opt for that. Or there's a lovely chocolate and almond torta caprese or hazelnut and chocolate, which is also very good. So I would go for one of those, I think. Oh, melanzana parmigiana, but it does take some time, but always good. Sorry, go on.
Based on your personal experience preparing this cookbook, what advice would you give to a young aspiring chef? What wisdom would you share with someone thinking about writing a cookbook but does not know where to start?
Uh-huh. So it's just perseverance and passion. I think for me, it's been really fundamental. Believing in your project, meaning if you want to do it, just it's going to be hard at times. My book had different life cycles. Sometimes I went for it and sometimes I stopped it and I thought maybe never to finish it. And then, but I always wanted to do it. I knew that I would have really regretted not to do it. And it was important for me to bring a message across. And I think I think people would have found the recipe handy and the story interesting. So believe in your project. I think my main motto is like find a passion and follow it through.
As we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you tell us about what you are working on now that this book is behind you? Where is your intention going?
So it's funny. It's like I just gave birth to this book. So my aim now is to really bring it to life and let it grow a little bit. I always find that it's like a question, you know, when if you meet someone or a boyfriend, so when are you going to get married? Or when you get married, it's like, when are you going to have a first child? So there's always, it's like, I'm actually at the moment, I'm really just enjoying the book coming to life because my main work and occupancy is really to cook every day. I cook for cookery demonstrations. I do. I work a lot with synagogues. I do food deliveries and do catering. So that's my day-to-day thing. So I started this morning, actually, I was talking to a colleague and I was talking about if I would do a second cookery book, how would title it? So maybe there may be some other ideas in my mind, but I am really mostly going back in the kitchen and cooking a lot because in the last year I've been writing a lot. So I will, I'm really much enjoying the cooking part of it and spreading the word by doing cookery demonstration and letting the book have its own natural growth. So that's where I am at the moment.
I wish you the very best. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
To our listeners, I am your host on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, Ari Barbalat. Today, I have been in dialogue with Sylvia Nakamuli. She is a cookery teacher and Italian Jewish food specialist living in London, England. Today, we've been discussing her new book, Jewish Flavors of Italy, a family cookbook, published in London by Green Beans Books 2023. Thank you.
Thank you so much.